You've heard me talk about the cabbage family before because you know I am a cabbage hustler. And that's because I'm a sulfur hustler. I want everybody to get their cabbage family in every day. But not only that, I just want you to get in leaves. You know, we don't think of foods as bulbs and roots and leaves and gourds, but as a botanist, that's how I began to categorize them. We look at tree fruits, and as a result of tree fruits, you go, well, what isn't a tree fruit? And then you look at something like a banana or a papaya, and you say, well, Eve, that's a fruit, but golly, really, botanically, it's an herb. And so we'll look at something like a pumpkin and say, well, that's a vegetable, but botanically, that's a fruit. And so we've got a lot of nomenclature that is used to describe these various categories of food, but the category of food I want to talk about today is leaves. You know, back in, quite a long way ago, over 30 years ago, when I first got involved in health and nutrition, one of the popularized pop things that was going on at the time was macrobiotics. Macrobiotics is a system of eating that was popularized by Michio Kushi. He was a leading proponent of this particular way of eating, adapted from Asian culture, and it talked about these various categories, roots and leaves and bulbs and seeds and grains and nuts. And as you looked at these various categories, they were assigned a value, an energetic value, a progression of understanding how these particular foods had an effect on our bodies. And so in Chinese medicine, they talk about things like heating and cooling and contracting and expanding. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that you get bigger and get smaller, expand and contract. But it really had to do with these fundamental energetic principles of the diet. And so when a seed sprouts underground, a shoot grows upward in the direction that is opposite that to the roots. You know, I always wondered, how come the roots go down and the leaves go up? You know, the shoot will turn into the stalk and the leaves, and they turn around and reach for the sky to absorb the light and transform it into matter. You know, they really are the seat of trapped sunlight. It still blows my mind when we think about the fact that water and sunlight turn into food. We need plants as the intermediates for our energy exchange with the universe. We do photosynthesize just like plants do. That's how we make vitamin D. We actually irradiate our skin and make vitamin D. So in that way, we are like a plant. But other than that, we can't manufacture our own food just from the sun and from the water. We require plants to be the intermediaries for this energy exchange. And so leaves really do the job. Leaves move in the wind. And in fact, in South America, the folk wisdom says that leaves are there to support motion. That if you want to have more movement in your life, you know, you want to run, you want to jog, you want to dance, then you need more leaves in your life. And it was interesting to note that people who start jogging or running ending up eating more salads. I don't know if that's a confirmation of it, but, you know, that's all South American folk wisdom, not just Chinese folk wisdom. You know, just the same as with roots, we can distinguish two kinds of leafy vegetables. They're those that taste light and bland, like the various lettuces. And then there are those that taste sharp or bitter, like mustard greens and watercress. And so even the, you know, the lettuce and the parsley and the dill, the light tasting things, are often the most popular ones. I want to talk today a good bit about those ones that are occasionally sharp and bitter and actually tell you how you can keep them from being sharp and bitter. But when we begin to look at leaves as a category, we find that, you know, in that photosynthesis, you know, that's a word that comes from the Greek, and photos, of course, means light, and synthesis means you pull it together. So lights pull together light and carbon dioxide to make sugar and starch. And photosynthesis is the most important function of the plants that produces chlorophyll. Now, not all plants produce chlorophyll, but that's the substance that makes leaves green. And chlorophyll is an incredibly hip molecule. You know, in botany, we always called it plant blood, because if you put a molecule of chlorophyll right next to a molecule of hemoglobin from your blood, the only thing that's really different about them is the mineral that's right in the middle. The hemoglobin molecule of your blood has iron in the middle of the molecule, but otherwise it's carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And chlorophyll has magnesium in the middle of it, but it's also carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. And so we always said that plant blood makes good human blood. And that's true. And besides that, chlorophyll is Mother Nature's natural deodorant. People that eat a lot of green foods very rarely have any body odors that are not unpleasant at all. When we take a real close-up look at leaves, you know, they're biochemical factories. This photosynthetic process fixes energy. You can hear my struggle for words, because it's such a miraculous process that takes place that, you know, light can shine on these leaves and that they can wiggle that light together with the water that gets taken up by the plant and make these tiny green bodies called chloroplasts, these green pigments that are stored when the processing of sugar takes place. The chloroplasts are really the workforce of the leaf, and they're constantly in motion. They're really nifty looking when you look at them under a microscope, or especially an electron microscope, because they're little spiral layers and they look like stacks of coins that you've sort of twisted off their straight up. Yeah, straight up. Okay, so you got a stack of coins, you know, and you tip them a little bit, and you can see that sort of spiral formation that takes place with chloroplasts. You know, molecules of chlorophyll, like all molecules, are made up of atoms, and that's the carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and magnesium. Well, you can hear the biochemist talking, you can hear the botanist talking as we speak about the energetics of foods, but, you know, leaves really are a quintessential vegetable. You know, they're the most prominent and abundant parts of the plant, and they're nutritious enough that many of our primate relatives eat little else. You know, when we look at the higher primates, the great apes, that's what they live on. And it's hard to believe that these great big giant gorillas, you know, some of which weigh 400 pounds or more, eat salad all day. You know, the salad of raw greens is really a primeval dish. But we can cook and eat the leaves of lots of different plants, from weeds to roots and fruit crops. And, you know, in the temperate regions like where we live, nearly all of the tender leaves of spring are edible. It's only when they get to be mature leaves that they start getting bitter. It was interesting when I visited Italy. Pistic is a dish that is made in, well, primarily northeastern Italy, but it's a collection of over 50 different wild greens that are boiled and then sautéed together. So perhaps the next time you make a visit in the springtime to northeast Italy, you will join them in a bowl of pistic. But what's true is that any place in the world, there is a celebration of bitter greens. On the Seder that celebrates a Jewish holiday, we include in our collection the bitter greens, because you have to remember, after the winter, when the winter was over and these first, you know, signs of spring appeared, these first tender leaves appeared, well, then that was quite a celebration. So whether we just, you know, blanch the leaves in some hot water or we saute them in a pan, all these distinctive aromas that come out of them, you know, often referred to as green or grassy. This is this stuff called leaf alcohol or leaf aldehyde that comes when the leaves are crushed or broken. And it's just appealing. So, you know, we all love lettuce. We all love salads. We want a piece of lettuce on our sandwich. We want a bowl, even of iceberg lettuce. You know, iceberg lettuce got really popular, not only because it was crunchy and wet, because it was pretty bulletproof to grow. Today, unless you buy it organic, that pale, watery, crisp head variety known as iceberg may be nothing more than a holding tank for pesticides. But, you know, it didn't show up on the American table until the 1920s or so. Head lettuces keep better than leaf lettuces. Their respiration rate, the way that the leaves take in and put out the oxygen and carbon dioxide, is very different than it is in leaf lettuces, and so they stay stable longer. You know, the nature of the leaf lettuce has a lot more nutrients in it than the head lettuces do. Well, we can even go so far as to say that we could take leaf lettuces and, you know, turn them pretty astringent. When you look at some of the red leaf lettuces, you've learned, because you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition on a regular basis, that the red leaf, red color, is an anthocyanidin pigment. And everybody in the listening audience knows that anthocyanidin is one of my very favorite words. These pigments that show up in red leaf lettuces are really noticeably astringent. It is the pigment itself that's doing it. You know, the eat a rainbow every day. Those pigments that occur in foods are really the antioxidants. They're really the powerhouses that are in the foods. And so even if we look at lettuces that have been under cultivation for 5,000 years, you know, there is some ancient Egyptian art that shows lettuces. So, you know, raw salads are very old in terms of the nature of the menu of humans. So when we look at the nature of lettuces, well, I think America's getting more sophisticated. There's a lot of people now that iceberg lettuce isn't their first choice. They're going to start getting those red leaves and maybe even get some of the novelty lettuces that are out there in the marketplace, because there's all sorts of hybrids that exist out there now. They're cultivated primarily to reduce the overall bitterness. And so that's going to be endive and escarole and chicory and radicchio. You know, those are things that are still going to have a little bit of bite to them. But growers really go to a lot of trouble to control their bitterness. It's interesting when you look at escaroles and endives, they're often tied into an artificial head to keep the inner leaves in the dark, and then that way they stay relatively mild. The Belgian endive is really an exotic thing. When you go to the market and you see Belgian endive and it's like $5 a pound or $7 a pound, well, you'll find out why, because it's a double grown version of what would otherwise be a very bitter chicory. You plant the seed in the spring and let it mature, and then you take all the leaves off, and actually you give them to the pigs for fodder, and you dig up the plant with the taproot and you throw it into cold storage. And then when the spring comes around again, you replant the root, but you keep it covered. You either put a bag over it, or you cover it up with soil and sand as it leafs out, or sometimes it's even grown hydroponically in the dark. The root takes about a month to develop that fist-size head of white or pale green leaves that have an incredibly delicate flavor and this wonderful crunchy texture. And it does so because it isn't allowed to develop the chlorophyll and some of the other compounds. And so we sell Belgian endive, but what's true is it's really kind of a prissy version of chicory. But, you know, I always get a kick out of it when I go into the market. If you take that endive and you put it in the plastic wrap and you leave it under the lights in the grocery store, you can still turn the leaves green again, and then they get bitter all over. So it sort of defeats the purpose of having Belgian endive in the first place. But, you know, we go through the leaves and we start looking at things like, you know, even dandelion. When I lived in Flagstaff, Arizona, and to a lesser extent when I lived in Sedona, but in Flagstaff, I was directly across the street from the San Francisco Peaks, the highest mountains in Arizona, just north of Flagstaff on the road to the Grand Canyon. And in the 3 years that I lived there, I finally began to appreciate what people talked about when they said it's dandelion spring, because the dandelions would literally pop up in the yard overnight. You know, they're found on all continents, and, you know, they're clearly cultivated a lot more in Europe and Asia than they are in the United States. But I got the opportunity to gather them wild. It is a perennial, so if the taproot is left intact, it will just keep putting out these rosettes of leaves. And so you'd take off these small, bitter leaves and, you know, blanch them in boiling water and then saute them into a dish, or the little tender ones in the spring you throw into a salad. Incredibly valuable for your liver. And I learned from some of the ladies that were out there in the West that I could pick the dandelion flower. And when I made pancakes, take that flour and put it into the pancake batter, you know, flour side up after you poured the pancake batter, and actually cook the dandelion flowers right into the pancakes. It was very lovely and made you feel tremendously organic and connected to the earth. Dandelion leaves, like marigold leaves, are really high in lutein, that pigment that is so protective to your macula in your eye and helps to prevent macular degeneration. But, you know, it's so rare that you get a nice dish of dandelion flower pancakes. We don't grow those things here in Florida, but, you know, they're another part of these leaves that we want to try to bring into the diet because they just have so many marvelous properties. But it's going to be hard for me to find leaves that are going to beat the cabbage family. You know, there are chemical warriors that are in the cabbage family that really deserve a trumpet flare. You know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't matter whether you're dealing with some of the weedy native plants or, you know, the cousins like radishes and the mustard plants. This is the most rich collaboration of nature's inventiveness in a plant that I can find, with the exception of onion family. I definitely have to put the onion family and the cabbage family as the top of the top as far as sharing elements of biochemistry that are disease preventive. So like onions, cabbages and their relatives stockpile two really different kinds of defensive chemicals in their tissues. They have these flavor precursors and enzymes. And when plant cells are damaged, these two stockpiles are mixed together and create these bitter, pungent compounds. Now, you know darn well, if you've ever cooked cabbage, if you cook it too long, the whole house stinks. Because this, you know, cabbage family creates these unique chemicals that get more bitter the longer that you cook them. And so there's your first clue that, for the most part, very many of these things are going to get cooked pretty quickly. You're not just going to put them on the stove and leave them on there all afternoon. In fact, the cabbage family system is effective enough to have inspired the man-made version, or the mustard gas that was used in World War I. When we look at these sulfur aromatic compounds, one of the reasons that I have been such a sulfur hustler for so long is because these defensive precursors that exist in the cabbage family are called glucosinolates. Now, before this show is over, you're going to have glucosinolates and isothiocyanates just rolling off your tongue. You thought anthocyanidins were a challenge. Well, strap in. These glucosinolates that really differ from the onion compounds because they don't just contain sulfur, they also contain nitrogen. And so they and their immediate flavor products, these isothiocyanates, are, yeah, they're bitter, but they have remarkable effects on our metabolism. The isothiocyanates can interfere with the proper function of the thyroid gland. I had a client in my office recently, and she said, oh, I was diagnosed as hypothyroid. And I was told that I shouldn't eat any cabbage or broccoli or cauliflower or Brussels sprouts or any of those things. Well, that's absolute nonsense, because what's true is, as long as you got plenty of iodine in your diet, and you've heard me talk about iodine before on No Nonsense Nutrition, then there is no issue whatsoever, even if you are hypothyroid, with eating as much of that cabbage family as you want to. But the real magic that exists in this family are these glucosinolates. And that's why cabbage and Brussels sprouts and broccoli and mustard greens have similar but very distinctive flavors, is because of these glucosinolates. Well, now we get to Dr. Paul Talalay. Dr. Paul Talalay, researching at Johns Hopkins University, discovered that First off, there is a striking reduction in the risk of developing cancers of people who eat large amounts of fruits and vegetables. This has been known for a very long time. I think the first time I ever read it was in Jean Carper's book, Food, Your Miracle Medicine. And she gave a quotation in there that people that eat the greatest volume of fruits and vegetables, no matter what they are, just the greatest volume, have the lowest rate of 10 cancers. People who eat the highest amount, well, conversely, people who eat the lowest amount of those fruits and vegetables, again, doesn't even matter which ones, have the highest rate of those 10 different cancers. Well, as they break that stuff down, they found out that the people who ate the crucifers, and crucifers is another name for the cabbage family, that they had incredibly low rates of cancers, all kinds of cancers. Prostate cancer, bladder cancer. Oh, and speaking of prostate cancer, I will be speaking today at Sarasota Memorial Hospital's auditorium at the group Man to Man, which is prostate cancer survivors. So if you're wanting to hear old Blondie lecture, you can join us today at Sarasota Memorial Hospital's teaching auditorium at 2 o'clock. I'll be lecturing there on some of these various things, glucosinolates and the prevention and treatment of prostate cancer using nutrients. So anyway, Paul Talalay looked at these edible plants that belong to the family Cruciferiae, or the genus Brassica. And again, this includes broccoli and cauliflower. And he found out that these isothiocyanates and these glucosinolates really inhibited cancers remarkably. And he also found out, as you know, the research had been there for some period of time, that this chemical defensive system that occurred in the Cruciferia family is most active, and thus the flavor is the strongest, in the young, actively growing tissues. The center of the Brussels sprouts, for example, portions of the cabbage core, they're twice as active as the outer leaves. I can remember when my mother used to cook cabbage, she would always cut the core out and chew it, and I would go, "Mom, that's so bitter." She loved it. She loved that taste, that bite that was there. So Paul Talalay, in doing this research and finding out that this interior part of these cabbages and Brussels sprouts and broccolis and things had the most glucosinolate, the most isothiocyanate, the most power in terms of these compounds, started looking at younger and younger plants. And he finally got to three-day-old broccoli sprouts, and he found out that they were incredibly loaded in glucosinolate. Well, the sprouts are now sold under the brand name Brocco Sprouts. And so if you ever see Brocco Sprouts out in the grocery or in the health food store, you'll know that probably a penny of, or maybe more, don't know, didn't read the contract, but some of that money from the patent on Brocco Sprouts goes to John Hopkins University into the research. And so when in 1992, now 16 years ago, when John Hopkins University School of Medicine identified this sulforaphane, which is what glucosinolate becomes, in the broccoli, they realized that many of these phytochemicals may explain why diets that are rich in fruits and cruciferous vegetables are associated with a reduced risk of cancer. So this started with the research that was done on animals, and now it's been confirmed in humans. Sulforaphane, in the form of its natural precursor, which is sulforaphane glucosinolate, see how these words start to roll off your tongue, is also found in things like kale and cabbage, but they found that the younger the broccoli sprouts were, the higher the concentrations of this stuff that we refer to in the business as SGS. Scientists believe that SGS burn really does boost the body's own antioxidant defense system. Now, your liver makes two sets of enzymes, phase one and phase two. Now, hang in with me because this is real, real important. When you get exposed to a toxin, it doesn't matter whether you're sitting on the bridge going to Siesta Key and you're breathing in diesel fume from the truck that's in front of you, or the people across the street spray their house with yard with pesticides, or you put in new cabinets and the formaldehyde is off-gassing from the cabinets. It doesn't matter where the toxin is coming from. You know, whether it's on your plate as a pesticide, whether it's environmental and you breathe it in, whether it's in a glass of water and you drink it. Once that toxin gets into your body, your liver is the one that's responsible for converting that toxin into a water-soluble excretable derivative. Right. A water-soluble excretable derivative. That means you breathed in the diesel fume, or you got exposed to the pesticide or the carpet glue or whatever it was, and your liver has to, in two steps, take these detoxification enzymes and rip that molecule apart so you can pee it away. That's exactly what detoxification really means. We take a non-water-soluble molecule and convert it into a water-soluble molecule and send it out in the stream of urine. So when scientists began to understand that sulforaphane glucosinolate, SGS, boosts the body's own antioxidant defense system, including upregulating these phase 2 detoxification enzymes, it does even more good than vitamin C and vitamin E. You know, many people are familiar with these common antioxidants that neutralize free radical activity before they can harm cells. These vitamins are now called direct antioxidants, whereas SGS is an indirect antioxidant. It doesn't neutralize the free radicals directly, but it actually boosts these liver phase 2 enzymes that can trigger ongoing and long-lasting antioxidant activity. Researchers now believe that SGS may be even more effective than direct antioxidants in protecting the cells against free radicals and other damaging compounds. So sulforaphane glucosinolate, whether we get it from a serving of coleslaw, or we get it from a serving of broccoli, or we get it from brocco sprouts, or we get it actually from a pill, it works as a catalyst to boost these phase 2 enzymes that exert these antioxidant activities. It's really a broad spectrum activity that eliminates many kinds of free radicals, and it cycles over and over again, meaning you don't use up the antioxidant. We actually can get the antioxidant to be recycled and used over and over and over again. So it's widespread throughout all of the cells. It doesn't just act in the water-soluble compounds of the body, such as the blood, like vitamin C does, and it doesn't just work in the fats, like on the cell wall, like vitamin E does. So it can protect against damage to the DNA. You know, that's our delicate blueprint inside the cell that enables us to have the next generation of the cells be viable. It protects lipids, the fats in our body, from going rancid. Ew, rancid fats. And remember, 60% of the weight of your brain, if you suck all the water out of it, is fat. And so you get rancid fats in your body, that means you get rancid fats in your brain. And that doesn't just happen in Washington, D.C., although it does seem to happen there a bit more than it does other places. We also can protect the body against these free radicals or these reactive oxidation processes that damage the cell. When we look at SGS, SGS continues to demonstrate to us an ability to protect every kind of cell. And so brand new research came out that showed how broccoli can help to boost an aging immune system. Eat your broccoli. UCLA researchers found that this chemical in broccoli, another cruciferous vegetable, may hold a key to restoring the body's immunity. So this is brand new news. This just came out in Science Daily barely a week ago, and it was published in the online edition of the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. The study's findings showed that sulforaphane, this chemical in broccoli, switches on a set of these antioxidant genes and enzymes in immune cells, which combat these injurious effects of molecules known as free radicals that can damage the cells and lead to disease. You know, free radicals are byproducts of the normal body processes. When we convert food into energy, we make free radicals in the meantime, and they can enter the body through these small particles present in polluted air, particulates as they're called. A supercharged form of oxygen, these molecules can cause oxidative tissue damage and lead to disease. In other words, they can trigger the inflammation that caused clogged arteries, as an example. You know, people keep thinking it's cholesterol. It ain't the cholesterol that's doing it. It's the inflammation that's doing it. So oxidative damage to body tissues and organs is really thought to be one of the major causes of aging. Now, it's not the only cause of aging. We talked in here before about telomeres, the end caps of your DNA. And every time cells replicate themselves, the telomeres get a little shorter. But if you exercise a lot, the telomeres don't get shorter. So exercise is probably the fountain of youth when it comes to reducing certain causes of aging. But we absolutely know that oxidative stress is one of the big pieces of aging. So the mysteries of aging have always intrigued humans. You know, when we look at the Dr. Andre Nail is the one of the directors at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And so, you know, he's the one that said, you know, that we've known that free radicals are important in aging. Most of the past attention is focused on the mechanisms that produce free radicals rather than addressing the pathways used by the body to suppress their production. So when we look at that equilibrium that happens between the mechanisms in the body that make free radicals and those that combat free radicals, it turns out that we're beginning to have a growing understanding of these defense pathways that our body uses to fight these free radicals. So Dr. Nell, who's a practicing clinical allergist and immunologist at this medical school at UCLA, his quote, "Insight into these processes points to ways in which we may be able to alleviate the effects of aging." I mean, do you hear that? We may be able to alleviate the effects of aging with broccoli? Who knew? So the delicate balance that exists between these pro-oxidant and antioxidant forces, pro-oxidative, it makes you oxidize more. You know, why don't I give iron to people over 50 years old? Because unless their blood values demonstrate that they need iron, iron is pro-oxidative. Now, in a menstruating woman and somebody who's got a job where they're out in the sun sweating like a pig on a regular basis, then they need iron because the three ways you lose iron are blood, sweat, and tears. So there's no question about the fact that, you know, people that are under 50 probably need iron to be supplemented. I'm talking about over and above what they can get from their food. But after age 50, we don't give people iron. Because a Finnish study demonstrated to us years ago that the higher the amount of iron in the body, especially in given as a supplement after age 50, the more that it actually contributed to aging. So there's got to be a balance between the pro-oxidant and the antioxidant forces. But iron isn't the only thing that does it. I mean, cigarette smoke does it. Diesel fume does it. You know, eating trans fats does it. You know, eating Dove bars does it. You know, going to the Stone Cold Creamery does it. You know, there are places where, you know, whether you're going to get a quad stacker, you know, at one of the burger joints with four hamburger patties, four slices of cheese, eight strips of bacon and sauce in a bun, you know, 1,000 calories and 30 grams of saturated fat and almost a teaspoon of salt. I mean, it doesn't just have to come from cigarette smoke and from other damaging compounds. It can come right off of our plate. But here's the great news. The great news is that the UCLA team found that not only the direct administration of sulforaphane and broccoli reversed the decline in cell immune function in old mice. Now, you don't get to test old people first. You don't get to take a truck to St. Pete and load up a whole bunch of old people and drive them to UCLA and feed them sulforaphane. You got to start out with the old mice. But the thing that was totally hip is that it didn't just reverse the decline in immune function in old mice, but they witnessed a similar result when they took individual immune cells from old mice, treated them with the chemical outside the body, and then placed the treated cells back into a mouse. This is astounding that we could slow aging with this simple chemical, but specifically slow the aging of the immune function. the scientists discovered that dendritic cells, and I think that this is going to become the buzzword for me for 2008, is dendritic cells. They're the ones that introduce infectious agents and foreign substances to the immune system. They were particularly effective in restoring immune system in these old animals when they were treated with sulforaphane. So not only do we have sulforaphane protecting us against cancers, but we got sulforaphane improving our immune system. So the author of the research scientist that was at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA said, and I quote, "We found that treating older mice with sulforaphane increased the immune response to the level of the younger mice." This is big. This is huge. So they investigated how this chemical in broccoli actually increased the immune system's response, and they found out that sulforaphane interacts with this certain protein, and in the business we refer to it as a NRF2, and it's NRF number 2, but you know those NRF balls that you throw? So that's what we're calling it. We're calling it a NRF2. It's a master regulator in the body's overall antioxidant response, and it's capable of switching on hundreds of antioxidant and rejuvenating genes and enzymes. So, okay, this is how it goes. You're going to have coleslaw with your lunch today. You're going to have broccoli with your dinner tonight. You know, tomorrow you're going to have some of those great leaves we talked about, like kale or Brussels sprouts or turnip greens or mustard greens. You're going to have any of these kinds of leaves because all of them are going to have sulforaphane, which is going to become glucosinolate, which in turn is going to interact with the NRF gene, which is going to switch on a whole bunch of rejuvenating genes in the body. This is very hip. I mean, unless you hang out in science books all day long, you may not be able to appreciate how incredibly hip this is, but I guarantee you, you want to get a member of the cabbage family in your diet every single blinking day. I bought some Brussels sprouts when I ran out to the market on Saturday night to get the stuff for Easter dinner, and they looked like Brussels sprouts on steroids. They were huge. They probably were the biggest Brussels sprouts I've ever seen. And I got them just because they were novel. And, you know, they come from a cabbage variant that develops. A lot of people think they're just baby cabbages, but they're not. They grow along an elongated central stalk. So if you could imagine that the core in a cabbage just kept growing up and little baby cabbages grew around the edge of it, you got a picture of what Brussels sprouts look like. They were developed in Europe in probably about the 15th century, but, you know, they started showing up in the botany books in about the 18th century. And so a lot of people go, ooh, Brussels sprouts, because people that are sensitive to bitter tastes are not going to react well to Brussels sprouts because they have very high levels of these glucosinolates. And one of them, called sinigrin, it's one of the precursors of mustard, really tastes bitter all by itself. But it produces a non-bitter thiocyanate. See how easy it is? See, it's starting, isothiocyanates start to sound like a normal word, isn't it? But when we cook sprouts rapidly to minimize the production of these thiocyanates, or we cook them slowly to transform all of it into glucosinolates, the result is still bitter. So these flavor components are concentrated in the center of the sprout. So if you cut the sprouts in half and cook them in a large pot of boiling water, you'll leach out some of those compounds, but you also reduce some of the protective ability of the glucosinolate and the sulforaphane and the isothiocyanates to protect your body. But if Brussels sprouts are too bitter for you, well, then just stick with the rest of the cabbage family. You know, look at cabbage in all of its forms. You know, Asian cabbages and their relatives like Chinese cabbage, bok choy, Napa cabbage, and tatsoi, which is one that I've never really eaten until just this year, we're members of one of the local farm co-ops, so that once a week we get a basket of vegetables, and here were these greens in there called tatsoi, which I never even had met before. They all stem from the same species that gave us turnips. And so Chinese cabbage, bok choy, Napa cabbage, tatsoi, all of these, they're, you know, some of the oldest cultivated plants that we have. They are incredibly important vegetables in Asia. So you can use all of these things, as well as broccoli and cauliflower and Brussels sprouts, arugula, radishes, horseradish. All of these things have some of those glucosinolate compounds in them. And so as you begin to look at how can I get these things into my diet? Well, I eat eggs usually 4 days a week. And the nature of having eggs in the morning, I generally will have them with sautéed onions and spinach, or sautéed onions and tatsoi, or sautéed onions and whatever greens are left over. You know, there were some collards. We had collards on Wednesday night, and on Thursday morning there were some collard greens left over. And so those collards got chopped up and put in with the onions and the eggs. You know, collards and kale and Portuguese cabbage really resemble wild cabbage, where they have these really short leaves along a stout main stalk, whereas cultivated cabbage generally will form large heads of these nested leaves, the ones that you see on the regular head cabbage. But the idea is all of them are wonderful. Sautéed together with onions, put your poached egg on top, put your sautéed vegetables on the bottom, and, you know, scramble an egg and put an egg over it and make it frittata style, or turn it into an omelet. At lunchtime, have coleslaw. Coleslaw is so fabulous. And, you know, there's a million ways to make coleslaw. There's a million grandmothers. There's a million coleslaws. So I happen to like my coleslaw with a spoonful of mayonnaise, a spoonful of plain yogurt, a spoonful of vinegar, usually a mild vinegar like rice vinegar, and a spoonful of honey. And it makes kind of a sweet sour. I don't like low-fat mayonnaise. I think it's disgusting. I think it tastes a lot like linoleum glue. And so I would much rather take my $8 a bottle organic mayonnaise and cut it with organic plain yogurt, 1 teaspoon to 1 teaspoon, rather than to buy the low-fat mayo. Some people like a vinegary coleslaw. They just as soon just, you know, sprinkle the balsamic, which makes a very interesting coleslaw, I might add, or the rice vinegar or apple cider vinegar on there, and turn it more into a tart slaw. Some people like it really creamy, where they mix buttermilk together with mayonnaise and make their coleslaw that way. But why can't you make coleslaw every week? It's cheap. It's easy to make. It's really a no-brainer. You want to make tricolored slaw and use green cabbage and red cabbage and throw some carrots in there for color? Great. And my girlfriend Ashley turned me on to putting just a little teeny tiny bit of scallion or a little teeny tiny bit of onion into the coleslaw. And thanks, Ashley, for that tip, because that really does add another dimension. And actually, combining those two favorite families, the cabbage family and the onion family, together further increases the protection that we get in the body of sulfur. What about dinner? Well, collards, love them. Well, I grew up in the South. And so you put the collards on the back of the stove with a piece of salt pork or a ham hock or a couple of strips of bacon, and you let the thing just cook all day. Well, I got to tell you, you're going to make it more bitter, actually, than if you cook it rapidly. But you're not going to get any more bang for your buck out of it by leaving it to cook all day long. The large leaf varieties of these things, like kale or collards, really cook fairly quickly. And so it's not unusual for me to wash them. And you got to wash them well, because they're always sandy. Wash them 2 or 3 times. Take out that tough rib in the middle. Throw it in the backyard for the raccoon, or put it on your compost pile. And then take those leaves, and you can either rip them apart, or you can, you know, take a knife and slice them apart so you put them into, you know, shreddy pieces. And I will often just take the water that sticks to them when they've been rinsed and just put the tiniest amount of water in the bottom of the pan, like 1/8 of an inch, just enough to cover the bottom of the pan. Put them in there and sort of, you know, steam them in that water that is stuck onto each leaf for 5 minutes, leave the lid on the pan, turn the fire off, leave it on the stove until I'm ready to eat. It doesn't really require anything any fancier than that. So maybe we'll turn No Nonsense Nutrition into a recipe site at some point in the future. But for right now, I'm just going to encourage you to use it. Take your broccoli. Broccoli has become the fourth most popular vegetable in the United States. And so people are eating a lot more broccoli. But what about broccoslaw? You know, cutting that up and making a cold slaw, taking your leftovers, throwing it in your salad. Broccoli soup, my favorite broccoli soup recipe. 4 cups of broccoli, 2 cups of potatoes, 1 cup of onion, barely half the amount of water. In other words, you put all the vegetables in the pot and just bring the water up about halfway. Boil the heck out of them for about 20 minutes. Put it in the food processor and burr it up. Put a little white pepper in it. You want it creamy? Add a little splash of half and half or a little splash of soy milk to it. I mean, that's the best broccoli soup I ever had. 4 parts of potato, 2 parts of four parts of broccoli, 2 parts of potato, and 1 part of onions. The potato is what makes it creamy. Take the skins off. You don't have to use a bunch of cream to make cream of broccoli soup. We got to find more ways to get these foods into us and into us on a daily basis. You're interested in more information about this? Go up, just type in Paul Talalay or type in glucosamine sulforaphates or sulforaphane glucosinolates or SGS. There's lots of information on the web on this research. There's over 100 papers that have been produced on sulforaphane. And, you know, the happy news is that Paul Talalay took that research one step further, and now they actually have it in a pill. And so we can take broccoli seeds that Paul Talalay developed himself. They're not genetically engineered. They're just selectively grown. And he turns them into a product, and the product is called Oncoplex. And so this is one of the ways that I get this sulforaphane into my diet every single day, and then I add the cabbage on top of that. Well, I hope I've encouraged you to have your coleslaw today.